asked, pointing to the vehicle outline on the wall. J.D. Hartley moves around New York in an up-armored Suburban. It's a serious setup, withstands up to 7.62 ammunition and even smaller IEDs. We use the same ones protecting the interim Iraqi government officials back in Iraq. It seemed like everyone wanted to kill those guys. Anyway, that is a measured outline of a Suburban. I want to know exactly where I have to stop the van to line up the EFP I'll have secured on the desk in the back. The explosive will turn the copper bowl you purchased into a molten slug, which will cut right through the armor and right through J.D. Hartley.
What if he has someone with him?
Then it just wasn't their day. He paused. Liz, I'll do everything I can to make sure it's just Hartley.
When is this going down, Reese?
A reporter friend of mine contacted a paparazzi photographer she knows in New York City to ask about Hartley. She said she was doing a piece on him and wanted some up-to-date, on-the-ground information. Apparently, he is spending his nights with a blonde real estate agent in Soho. I even have the address. Liz watched Reese from across the hangar. If he blew himself up, he did not want her to die as well. She watched as he cautiously emptied fertilizer into a bucket of water, stirring it with the broom handle before adding a golden red fluid from the chemistry set catch flask. He then slowly poured what had then transformed into a milky white froth onto one of the bed sheets he had strung between a set of chairs. To Liz, it reminded her of the jellies she would make with her grandmother as a child, watching the liquid slowly drip through cheesecloth over the kitchen table. Reese focused the heat lamp on the bedsheet and then moved to a table farther away from the concoction he had just created, presumably to limit the damage in case the next batch did not go as planned. From her vantage point, it was difficult for Liz to tell what he was doing. She could see him mixing shots of what appeared to be the pool and concrete cleaners with nail polish remover into the chemistry glassware, swirling it around and then pouring it into a coffee filter he had secured over a round bottom flask. She could tell he was being as meticulous as possible during this portion of the process, and she wondered whether this was the part where terrorists sometimes unintentionally exploded. With pliers, he pulled the bullet out of a 5.56mm cartridge case and poured the powder on the table. Liz was transfixed, thinking that at any moment she might watch as the man she was closest to in this world entered the next. From a string of red, green, yellow, and blue Christmas tree lights, Reese cut a single bulb, heating up the end with a candle before dipping it into water to break off the tip. She knew this was a delicate part of the procedure as she watched Reese pack the cartridge case with his newly created mixture and place the broken light inside, securing it with hot glue. It dawned on her that from elements that usually brought happiness and joy, Christmas and swimming pools, Reese was brewing up a mixture of death. When he was done, Reese stood and slowly moved away from the table. He looked tired and relieved. "That went well," he said. "The good old Mujahideen slam, and we're even still alive."
"Well, wonders never cease," Liz replied,
obviously as relieved as he was. "It will take at least overnight to dry the urea nitrate on the bed sheets. That's the equivalent of TNT and will be the primary explosive. The heat lamp should help speed up the process. The dangerous part is done. Tomorrow I'll pack the PVC pipe with the explosive and place the copper bowl under the collar. Set the firing cap I just made into the back, and attach the light bulb to the wireless doorbell. Not bad for an amateur."
"I'm just glad we are all still in one piece," Liz stated.
"Me too. Let's get some rest. Over the next few days, we're going to need it." Chapter 68. New York, New York. Anthony Craig did not like his job. Well, it wasn't his job per se, it was the person his job required him to drive around New York that he disliked. As a young black kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 1960s and 70s, he had been headed down a dark path. That was until his father took a day off from his janitorial duties at an investment bank on Wall Street, something Anthony could only remember him doing that one time in order to take him to lunch. Instead of getting a bite to eat, they had walked to the Marine Corps recruiting office on Chambers Street. The Marines had knocked the chip off his shoulder and turned his life around. After his father's early death from a heart attack, Anthony left the Corps and returned home to New York City. He married a woman whom he'd met at church, and they raised two children, who were both now in college on academic scholarships. Now in his mid-50s, he was proud of the life he had created. He was not proud of the man he was driving around. It wasn't that J.D. Hartley treated him poorly. In fact, it was just the opposite. Despite Hartley's philandering, he was generally well-liked by everyone. Hartley was at a point in his life where his adultery was a part of his persona and even an element of his national identity. He had been elected to Congress from the great state of California despite being caught red-handed on multiple occasions in compromising situations, both financial and extramarital. But what was acceptable in California was not palatable to a national electorate. After a failed presidential election bid, he had let his wife take the spotlight as she worked her way through positions of power all the way up to Secretary of Defense. J.D. had occupied himself running his consulting company, lobbying and building his foundation, with the mission of bringing computers and education to the Third World. This allowed him to attend fundraisers where he was the toast of the evening, surrounded by adoring women who found his mischievous ways intensely alluring. What offended Anthony wasn't the lifestyle or elitism of his current employer. It was the fact that J.D. Hartley had assumed from day one that because Anthony was black, he was by default a liberal Democrat and supportive of the Hartleys' political leanings. Anthony had seen liberal policies fail his community time and time again, promoting an entitlement culture that he believed was the cause of the problems rather than the solution to them. In any event, Anthony was a man of God and a professional. He smiled and made small talk when necessary, always on time, and always gassed up and ready to go. Today his boss had made him wait longer than usual. Anthony had parked the Suburban right in front of the Soho apartment where Hartley had spent the night with his latest mistress, a well-endowed real estate agent in her early 30s. He must have really been on a roll as he'd spent the entire day with her in the apartment building, finally calling for Anthony in the late afternoon. The doorman allowed Anthony to park in the loading zone while he waited for the former congressman. Anthony had the satellite radio set to a classical music station as he surveyed the Manhattan evening. He loved the hustle of New York and would never think of working elsewhere. The vitality of the people moving along the sidewalks, the constant stream of traffic, and the majesty of the buildings never got old for him. It was his city. The melancholy of Richard Strauss's Im Abendrot filled the Suburban. Anthony loved classical music almost as much as he loved New York. Pairing the two was majestic. Knowing that the piece was written with the calm acceptance of death as its inspiration seemed in sharp contrast with the life surrounding Anthony's current piece of early evening New York energy. A wave from the doorman signified that Congressman Hartley was headed down. Anthony exited his vehicle, pushing the heavy armored door open, and moved to the right rear passenger side to open the door as Hartley exited the building with a spring in his step.
"Good evening, Anthony,"
Hartley said with a confident smile full of magnificent white teeth as he approached the car in an immaculate navy blue suit and bright yellow tie.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, but duty called." "Good evening, Congressman,"
Anthony replied as he opened the door for his employer, shutting it behind him and making his way around the front. The black Sprinter van almost knocked him off his feet.
"Whoa,"
Anthony stammered as he regained his balance.
"Hey,"
he yelled at the Sprinter driver. The van had pulled in right next to the congressman's Suburban, so close that it had knocked the left side view mirror off the vehicle.
"These young delivery guys are crazy,"
thought Anthony, bringing his arms up in an incredulous shrug as if to say, "Well, now what?" As he moved back to the front of the Suburban, he got a good look at the driver of the van. With a full beard and unkempt hair, he looked more like a mountain man than a delivery driver.
It was when he slid from the front seat and moved parallel and forward of the pinned vehicle that Anthony realized this was no delivery driver. Time seemed to slow for Anthony as he looked through the front window to see Hartley in the back seat, reading his paper, unmoved by the commotion caused by the sprinter. Switching his attention back toward the van driver, he noticed something small and white in his left hand. He appeared to be looking not at Hartley and not at the Suburban, but at the people on the sidewalk. It was only then that Anthony realized what was happening. He had to get Hartley out of the car. That was his last thought, before a sound he had not heard since his basic demolition training in the Marine Corps 35 years earlier erupted from the sprinter. Fire, deafening noise, and a shockwave unlike anything he had ever experienced reverberated through his body and sucked the air from his lungs. The congressman's Suburban rocked onto its side against the curb while the front of the apartment building absorbed an impact that Anthony thought might take down the building. Wide-eyed, he stared at the formerly peaceful street that had just been transformed into a war zone. When he turned back toward the bearded man, all he saw was traffic and chaos. Chapter 69. Reese turned the corner and ran east, blending in amongst the masses of humanity desperate to flee the site of the explosion. He couldn't help but think of similar images from television 16 years earlier, images that sent Reese and his brothers to far corners of the globe in search of those responsible. Improvise, Reese. He saw an opportunity and reacted instantly, grabbing a wide-brimmed black hat from the head of a Hasidic Jew jogging in front of him. The man turned instantly to his left to recover his sacred hat, but Reese brushed past the man on his right side and continued forward. The sheep-like crowd sensed the lack of danger and began to slow as human curiosity started to set in. Much to Reese's shock, people began pulling out their phones to check news sites, take video, and even to post to social media accounts, lest anyone miss a single moment of their shared life experience. Getting caught carrying a gun in New York City was an absolute no-go. As much as Reese loved his Glock 19 for its reliability and durability, it was a little big to conceal from a trained eye. Getting spotted by a sharp-eyed NYPD officer for carrying a concealed handgun would bring his mission to a screeching halt. He'd have a tough time talking his way out of the encounter, and shooting it out with the cops here was a really bad plan. He wasn't about to go unarmed at this point, though, so he had compromised firepower for concealment. The Glock 43 was a compact, single-stack magazine version of the larger Austrian pistol that shared its 9mm chambering. Reese's pistol had been extensively customized by Zev Technologies in Oxnard, California, and Reese could shoot it almost as well as he could its larger relative. With the slim but powerful handgun in an appendix holster, Reese could defend himself and potentially break contact if it were absolutely necessary. He desperately hoped that wouldn't be the case. Reese slowed his pace to a jog and eased to the edge of the crowd, switching to a brisk walk. He turned north down an alley, placing the hat atop his head. Removing his backpack as he walked, he took out a black Arc'teryx fleece and pulled it on. The disguise wouldn't bear close scrutiny, but along with his full beard, it would work at first glance. The alley took Reese to another eastbound street where he turned right and began looking for a cab. It had been years since he'd visited New York, and it took him a few tries before he decoded the meaning of the light bars on the taxi's roofs. Finally spotting an empty car, Reese walked out in front of it to block its path. The driver stopped and he quickly climbed inside. "Brooklyn, Best Bayon Belt Parkway," Reese said in his best Eastern European accent, uncertain whether his mimicry even matched his preposterous disguise. The ordinarily bad Manhattan traffic turned to near-instant gridlock as news of the explosion spread across the borough. The rumor mill came alive with speculation, half-truths and blatant lies, panic spreading like a wildfire in a gale. What should have been a short drive turned into a painful crawl. The driver, who appeared to be from somewhere in Central Africa, turned up the local news station to listen to the breaking story. Reese braced for a description of the bomber and lowered his head, as if in prayer. It struck him that now wouldn't be a terrible time to ask the man upstairs for help. "Please, God, all I've ever asked of you was to watch over my family. Let me avenge their deaths." Initial eyewitness accounts indicated the perpetrator was a male of Middle Eastern descent. The tall American of Scandinavian ancestry, dressed as a Jew from Eastern Europe, had to chuckle at the description. Maybe Hartley has a point about our xenophobia after all. As they crossed into Brooklyn, Reese reached into the pocket of his jeans for the last of his throwaway cell phones. It was a flip phone without the benefit of a full keyboard, so it took him longer than normal to type out the text message. "Pick me up at Mom's in 30. Darkness came early this time of year, and so by the time the taxi made its way into the shopping area near Coney Island, night had fallen. Reese paid the hefty cab fare in cash, leaving a 20% tip, enough not to be remembered as a guy who stiffed the driver but not generous enough to stand out. It would probably be too late by the time anyone tracked down the driver, but there was no use taking unnecessary chances. The other side could always get lucky. He climbed out of the cab into the chilly night air. The temperature had dropped into the high 40s, and it was starting to rain. Perfect. Reese stood for a moment and pretended to use his cell phone as the cab sped away in search of his next fare. Reese walked south, past a hotel, a wholesale club, and a Mercedes dealership. As he passed through a relatively dark area between the lights of two businesses, he took the ill-fitting hat from his head and flung it like a frisbee off into the weeds. He retrieved a battered ball cap from one of his old platoons out of his pack and pulled it on low and tight. The insignia would be meaningless to all but a few people, most of whom were dead. "See you soon, boys." Reese turned right on Bay 41st Street and headed toward the water. Airports and train stations were full of cops, surveillance cameras, and sophisticated software to track the comings and goings of passengers. Marinas, however, were what Churchill would have called the soft underbelly of transit, with minimal, if any, security or surveillance. The Marine Basin Marina was scheduled to close at 5 o'clock p.m., and the employees were too engrossed in their closing rituals to notice a solitary figure walk through the gate in the rainy darkness. Reese could see the running lights of his Exfil ride floating just off the end of the marina's long pier. The boat, expertly driven, pulled close as he approached, the driver controlling the throttles to keep the vessel from smashing into the concrete pilings in the choppy waters. Reese walked off the end of the pier and landed on the deck with well-practiced grace. The driver seemed to take no notice as he accelerated the boat away from the shoreline.
"Thanks for the ride, Rafe," Reese said as he approached the driver at the helm. "Don't mention it, eh?"
Rafe Hastings replied without taking his eyes off the water. He spoke with a slight accent that most would assume to be South African. Reese knew better. Chapter 70. Fisher's Island, New York. The 38-foot protector Tauranga bobbed in the dark waters of Fisher's Island Sound, between Fisher's Island, New York, and Ram Island, Connecticut. Located at the eastern tip of Long Island Sound, Fisher's Island had long been associated with the military as a base for naval forces up to and through World War II. These days, it was the lesser-known cousin to the Hamptons. Though at only 9 miles long and 1 mile wide, it was arguably more exclusive. Once a guardian to the waters of the northeastern United States, it was now an escape for the ultra-rich, with two private clubs and one of the most sought-after rounds of golf on Earth. With less than 250 year-round residents, it was the perfect escape for the country's most discerning families. In late October, few lights burned in the homes spaced generously along the shoreline. Reese had his thermal imager focused on one in particular. They had timed it for a slack tide, as currents were exceptionally strong here. There was very little maritime traffic tonight due to the wind and weather, which both continued to build, but the triple 350-horsepower outboard motors of the Protector had no trouble holding station in the rough seas. Originally built for the New Zealand Coast Guard, its ridged fiberglass hull and surrounding inflatable chambered hypalon tubes made it strikingly similar to the ribs that SEALs had used in maritime operations for most of Reese's time in the Navy. Though, this one was built with luxury, not effectiveness in war as its guiding design principle. Rain pelted down around them, but neither man seemed to care. Good operating weather. Rafe manned the helm. He had been quiet most of the trip. At 2 inches taller than Reese's 6 feet, but with shoulders to match, he looked like an MMA fighter trapped in a cowboy's body who somehow found himself captaining a ship at sea. Wisps of dirty blonde hair snuck from beneath a black watch cap-style beanie and betrayed the fact that this guy did not spend much time in a boardroom. The scar that ran from the corner of his left eye and ended just shy of his upper lip gave his rugged features a menacing look. Even though it was dark, his green eyes pierced the night like a nocturnal predator. "Okay, I've seen what I needed to," said Reese, lowering his thermal. "Take me around to windward. I don't want to come right in on them. They probably expect that coming from a frogman." Rafe nodded, but didn't say a word. He pushed the throttle forward and the agile boat sprang to life, easily handling the choppy waves and turbulent weather for which it was engineered. Deftly piloting around the eastern tip of the island, he slowed his advance and maneuvered the protector west. Anyone looking from shore would think he was just one more rich yachtsman who didn't check the weather and had bitten off more than he could chew, now making his way back home to Long Island in his expensive toy, choosing to avoid the notoriously hard-to-navigate shallow rocks of the Sound, termed the Clumps. "This is good," Reese told his larger companion. "Just over a mile offshore." Katie had accessed her work database and spent hours sifting through public and private records of the Hartleys, attempting to piece together the SecDef's most probable location. There had to be a place off the books where she would hole up. Then, Katie found it. Hidden deep within the convoluted financials of the Hartley Family Foundation was a write-off for a foundation planning office. The address was a post office box in New York, but a phone number listed on one of the mandatory 501c3 forms had a Connecticut prefix. Katie narrowed her search to counties bordering Connecticut and cross-referenced those with geodata location information embedded in the newer digital photos taken of the couple over the last 3 years. Matching that data, Katie found what she was looking for. She passed the information to Reese via Signal and wished him luck. Tracking down Steve Horn had not proven to be the most difficult of tasks. What tipped the scales toward the nautical utopia of northern New York came from Liz, who had activated her contacts in the aviation community. A day after the mission to kill Reese in New Hampshire had ended in a dry hole, a Gulfstream IV, owned by Capstone Capital, landed at Francis S. Gabreski Airport in West Hampton Beach, New York, where it remained with its pilots on standby. Utilizing her knowledge and associates in the industry, Liz had discovered that Horn had chartered a Eurocopter AS-350 helicopter to make the 37 nautical mile flight from West Hampton to Fishers that same day, as the airfield on the island was not nearly long enough to accommodate something the size of a Gulfstream. All signs pointed to Fishers. Rafe watched his former teammate adjust the last of his gear he had liberated from his cage back in Coronado. Reese was dressed in a black wetsuit. The areas of his face and neck not covered by his beard were painted a pattern of black and dark green, and a Draeger LAR-5 rebreather was strapped to the front of his chest. His M4 was secured inside a shoot-through waterproof bag to ensure that it would work when he got to shore. A waterproof backpack with a valve for ballast held his web gear and other over-the-beach mission essentials. Attached to his weight belt was an attack board. This neutrally buoyant plastic rectangle, about the size of a small laptop, was built around the bubble of an exceptionally tough compass. It also held a G-Shock watch set to the stopwatch feature, along with a depth gauge, all illuminated by a tiny chemlight wrapped in black rigger's tape so that only a sliver of light escaped. These tools would allow him to navigate to his target undetected. His gear ready, Reese stood, faced his friend, and extended his hand. Rafe paused, but clasped it in a firm grip.
"Thank you," Rhys said over the roar of the downpour, more sincerely than he'd ever said anything in his life.
"What you need has been put in place. It's confirmed."
"Thank you," Rhys said yet again.
"I owed you," Rafe said, clearly stressing the past tense of the word.
Rhys managed a slight smile, then moved to the leeward edge of the Protector's inflatable sponson, pulled his mask over his darkened face, inserted his mouthpiece, and initiated the pre-breathing sequence to purge his body of carbon dioxide before beginning his insertion on the pure oxygen rebreathing system. After a few minutes of breathing through the system on the surface, he was ready to go.
"Hey, Rhys, this evens us up," Rafe said firmly.
Rhys nodded and slipped into the dark waters of the Atlantic.
Chapter 71 J.D. and Lorraine Hartley had rented the Fisher's Island home for the past 15 years through a shell corporation attached to their family foundation. It afforded them both the anonymity they sometimes required, as well as a healthy write-off for tax purposes. It sat just off a beautiful beach facing New London, Connecticut. Nothing like living the good life to help the world's downtrodden. Though not nearly as opulent as homes belonging to families with names like Rockefeller and DuPont, it was not quite a shack either. Despite their picturesque location, the Hartleys had been eyeing an estate on the east end of the island, closer to the golf course. A rock stairway built into the cliff led to a perfectly manicured lawn above which a New England-style home, straight out of a Currier and Ives print, sat surveying its domain. J.D. had spent considerably more time there over the years since his untimely departure from politics. He found it was the perfect place to conceal his philandering ways from the watchful eyes of the paparazzi, not to mention his wife, who had proven much more adept at the political game than her ne'er-do-well husband. Tonight, that ne'er-do-well husband was missing from the picture of classic East Coast perfection. His body was confirmed to have been the one inside an armored Chevrolet Suburban, outside the Soho apartment of a blonde less than half his age. It took a few hours to confirm the identity of the congressman, due to the fact that there was not much left of him after he was eviscerated by a slug of molten copper that turned his armored car and his body into an inferno of melted steel, glass, flesh, and bone.
"How the fuck did that bastard find him?"
Lorraine Hartley asked, as much to herself as to the well-dressed Steve Horn next to her. She had enough trouble tracking down her husband. That Rhys was able to do it with apparent ease made her even angrier. She noted the calm, composed demeanor of the man next to her. He was beginning to annoy her with how, even in their current predicament, he still maintained an element of style and poise. Steve Horn swirled the Remy Martin Louis XIII cognac in his crystal snifter, leaned back in the massive leather chair, and looked into the smoldering embers of the fire in the great stone fireplace before him. Noticing that the Secretary of Defense seemed much more concerned with how Rhys found her husband than she was with the fact that he was now dead, he chose his words carefully before responding.
"Listen to me, Lorraine," he began, sounding almost condescending. "This entire venture has no doubt taken a turn for the worse. I made my money being strong when others were weak, looking for opportunity in the chaos. In this case, Madam Secretary, we have an opportunity to make even more money than before."
Lorraine Hartley couldn't believe what he was saying. Even at a time like this, he still thought about how to maximize profits.
"While Commander Rhys has been running around killing everyone like a madman, he has also been stacking the deck in our favor and playing right into our hands. With Boykin, Holder, Saul, Howard, Pilsner, and now your husband, God rest his soul, out of the way, we stand to make a significantly greater sum of money. Not to mention, there are far fewer loose lips. With your capital still intact, and with you the seemingly obvious choice to win your party's nomination for the presidency, you will be able to push FDA approvals for the vital drugs needed to inoculate our servicemen
from the ravages of PTSD before they go into combat. Think, Lorraine. Who better to push for this initiative than a female president whose very husband was murdered by a veteran suffering the effects of PTSD? Also, thanks to Commander Reese, you will be able to greatly expand the powers of the executive branch and pass the Domestic Security Act. We get richer and more powerful, and the country gets safer. And we can all live without fear, he added for effect.
Steve, you don't get it, do you? He is going to kill us all.
Nonsense. He could see she was coming unglued. He could not have that in a commander-in-chief he planned to control. It was unbecoming.
Do I need to remind you what he's done so far, Steve?
She said, almost on the verge of hysteria.
He cut off that Muslim cleric's head. He left it on a spike outside the mosque. He gutted poor Howard. My people tell me he was eaten alive.
Madam Secretary, I want you to listen very carefully to what I am about to tell you. What happens here tonight, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps the next, will catapult you into the White House. Hartley looked at him incredulously.
Has he lost his mind?
We are not safe here, Madam Secretary. At some point very soon, that maniac Reese will make an attempt to kill us, which is exactly what we want. Our trap is set. It is time we finished this.
You said my house here would be safe,
she stated meekly. I had to get you here, Lorraine. It is nearly impossible to hide everything in today's age of information. Someone who knows how to dig will find it, and in this case, he said, pausing, someone did.
Chapter 72 Reese's scan via both thermal and night vision from the protector had yielded nothing out of the ordinary. Maybe they weren't there. Maybe he had missed his shot. Another headache had hit him on the way in, though this one was not nearly as severe as the one that almost crippled him in the mosque. He never knew which headache might be his last. Not knowing the speed with which his tumor was growing made it even more imperative that he finish the names on his list before joining his wife and daughter. The insertion via LAR-5, a classic frogman combat swimmer operation, allowed him to avoid the thermals and night vision of any security detail. Ending up under the long-abandoned dock attached to a part of Fisher's Island, still owned by the Navy and occasionally used to monitor submarine activity off the coast, Reese used a pylon to conceal his combat peak. Slowly scanning the beach, cliffs, stairs, and high ground of the long-defunct outpost. Conspiracy theories had swirled around the island for years that the prohibited area was operating some sort of biological weapons development lab, akin to the rumors surrounding Plum Island to the south. Reese hoped tonight that the speculations were just that. Rumors. Reese unhooked his Draeger, flooded it, and let it sink away. Then he attached his fins to his weight belt and dropped them to the ocean floor, before working his way under the dock to the rocky shore. He was committed. The rain and wind masked any noise he made, removing his M4 from its waterproof bag and quickly transitioned out of his wetsuit and into his AOR-2 woodland-patterned camouflage combat pants and shirt. He slipped his magazine carrier over his head and attached his pistol belt to his waist. Then, donning his bump helmet with NODs, he scanned ahead and moved toward the stairs. At the top of the steps, Reese turned and headed northeast, coming to a kneel in a small clearing to listen and observe. The weather played to his advantage tonight, masking his movement and keeping civilized people indoors where it was dry and warm. Reese studied the GPS he always kept on the stock of his M4, bringing back memories of the last time he had checked it, just prior to the ambush in Afghanistan. It would all be over soon. Moving as if guided by the souls of those warriors who could not exact vengeance themselves, Reese pushed through the thick woods of the island paradise, past red oaks, American beech, and red maples, aided by the howling wind and pelting rain. It was a good night for a reckoning. Sticking to the woodline, Reese skirted the meadows and ponds, giving the large homes he encountered a wide berth, even though they were essentially abandoned at this time of year. Unencumbered by the usual weight of his body armor, He worked his way swiftly and silently toward his target. The thick shrubs and grasses, soft earth and decaying logs through which he now moved, reminded him more of Central America than what he had assumed he would find off the coast of New York. He would have loved to explore wilderness like this, with his children, had they not been murdered by those he now hunted. Arriving at what overseas he would have termed his set point, Reese stopped again, just back from the tree line, looking out at his target building. The rain combined with the humidity created by his body during his patrol from the Atlantic side of the island caused his NODs to fog up with irritating regularity, though it certainly was better than not having them at all. Reese settled into a comfortable position and observed his objective. Finally, he saw them, sitting out of the rain in the dry warmth of the idling SUV with a commanding view of the water just to the side of the opulent home's driveway. The four men, who were undoubtedly supposed to be out in the elements patrolling the perimeter, were sitting in the Chevy Tahoe texting away to fight the boredom. Apparently, they didn't think it was possible for him to get there this quickly, which explained the absence of a rear security element. Through his NODs, he could see their faces illuminated by the light of their smartphones, all of them not only distracted from their jobs by the lure of the digital world, but their night vision ruined by the LCD screens. They undoubtedly had access to NODs, but none appeared to be wearing them. Odd. The same senses that had kept him and his men alive on the front lines of the War on Terror until that last deployment were now telling him something was wrong. Last time you didn't listen to that voice, you got your entire element killed, Reese. Last time I cared about keeping my men alive. Now it is just me, and I am already dead. Patience, Reese. No need to rush to your death. Make it count and finish the job. Keep scanning. That's when he spotted the sniper. Chapter 73. To the south, 50 yards off the main home, sat a quintessential guest cottage built in the same style as its larger companion. A flicker of light, perhaps from a headlamp or a cigarette lighter, illuminated a window and then went out. Sometimes that's all it takes in this game. It was a good position, an urban hide site, out of the elements, in control of the high ground with a commanding view of the water, dock, and beach below. The goons in the Tahoe were bait. The sniper was there to finish him. Their mistake had been assuming Reese would come directly from the sea. That, and not posting rear security. Reese crept farther back into the woodline and worked his way into the dead space behind the cottage, stopping once again to look and listen for anything out of the ordinary. Satisfied that he had the critical element of surprise in his favor, he moved smoothly from tree to tree until he was standing at the entrance to the cottage, M4 at the ready. The door was unlocked, and Reese slowly pushed it to the side. "Hey, Tim, you're supposed to radio in before coming over," the sniper said angrily, turning from his seated position at a table, set up the same way a bench rest shooter would in competition. He was situated in the back of the small living area, furniture pushed to the side to give the gunman an unobscured view and clear bullet path down to the low ground. Reese's M4 spat once, the suppressor muffling the sound to an almost inaudible level with the howling wind as a backdrop. The bullet impacted his would-be killer's head with a wet thwack, throwing brains and tissue over what Reese recognized as an Accuracy International 338 Lapua topped with a Schmidt and Bender scope. Nice rifle. Reese approached the contorted body and, slinging his carbine, found the man's radio and headset, listened for a moment for any incoming radio traffic, and then attached it to his web gear before moving back into the storm. One more group of contractors to deal with. To Reese, it mattered little that they undoubtedly had wives, children, girlfriends, or parents waiting for them at home. To him, they were mere targets, obstacles, blocking him from his ultimate objective. To that end, they were going down. When you lived this life, that was part of the contract. Don't let it be a surprise when the Reaper comes to call. Reaching into his pack, Reese readied the demolition charge, the last of his armory acquisitions from back in Coronado. It seemed like years ago that he had started preparing for this evening's mission, though in a way, he had been preparing for it his entire life. Starting the timer on the MK-147 time delay firing device, Reese set it for a 10-minute countdown. He crawled on his hands and knees to the rear of the SUV and slid the demo as far forward as he could reach. Then, retreating from the vehicle, he set his sights on the mansion. Chapter 74. Steve Horn was on his third brandy when he felt, rather than saw, the figure emerge from the shadows. Though he knew it was a possibility, he couldn't quite fathom how Reese had made it past the contractors. They were supposed to be the toughest mercenaries available. Even with one last fail-safe contingency plan still in place to kill the Navy commando, Horn was surprised by the fear the dark man in NODs appearing from nowhere instilled in him.
"Commander Reese," Horn said in a louder voice than necessary in an attempt to bolster his confidence and composure.
Lorraine Hartley jumped in her seat at Horn's abrupt shout. Reese moved slowly into the room, lifting his NODs back on his helmet. His dark beard, face paint, and gear dripping rainwater only added to his intimidating appearance. In front of the fire, sitting with Lorraine Hartley and Steve Horn, a brandy in one hand and what appeared to be a small box in the other, was Ben Edwards. Reese had expected all three. What he didn't expect was the fourth person, kneeling on the rug next to Ben, hands bound behind her back, a bandana running between her teeth and tied around her head, face battered and hair a mess, was Katie Buranek.
"You son of a bitch,"
Reese hissed, raising the M4. Ben said, holding up and shaking the box in his hand. In response to Reese's questioning look, Ben brushed Katie's hair back with the hand holding his snifter, revealing multiple strands of what looked to be thin, yellow rope wrapped around her neck.
"Yeah, that's det cord, buddy. And yes, this is a detonator," he said, shaking the box once more. "You don't have these little toys in the teams yet, bro. In case you were wondering, my thumb has to press the button here. As soon as it comes off, pop, off comes Katie's head."
Reese kept his weapon trained on Ben, but had a healthy eye on the SecDef and Horn.
"You don't look surprised to see me, bro. I couldn't believe it when I finally put it together, Ben. I had my suspicions, but the assault force at your cabin confirmed it. You were the only one who knew I was going there."
"Yeah, I figured that would cue you in. Mistake on my part. It did allow you to almost finish your list, though, which helped us out immensely, by the way. I still can't believe you had those guys in a textbook ambush and let them live. Getting soft, buddy. How could you be involved in this, Ben? How could you be a part of killing Lauren and Lucy?" "Shit, bro, I didn't do that. By the time I was brought in, those decisions were made. The SecDef here just wanted me to see what you knew about the tumors. I had no idea they were going to kill your family. Once they did, there was no turning back the clock. I'm sorry how it went down, bro, but this is bigger than you or me. So you kept it from me and then used me to kill off everyone who knew about the experiments. SecDef gets elected, the Domestic Safety Act gets passed, and you all make your fortunes from RD-4895. Everybody has a price, bro. Apparently mine has 10 figures.
Reese stared at his best friend in a disgusted rage.
"That's why you never gave me any location information on this guy?" Reese asked, gesturing toward Horn. "You needed him to keep this plan moving forward. You needed him in place for your payday." "You were always the smart one, Reese. And yeah, that was why you weren't killed at the condo. You were being so efficient, tying up our loose ends while at the same time increasing our share of the profits, that the logical business decision was to allow you to keep at it. Up until now, that is. I was actually nervous you would put it together quicker than you did. Those emotions got to you, bro. Kept you from seeing the whole picture."
"And J.D. Hartley?"
Reese asked, looking at the SecDef. Not able to even form a sentence, Lorraine Hartley looked in loathing at Steve Horn.
"Don't act surprised, Lorraine," Horn said in partial dismissal. "His death helped propel you into the White House with the sympathy vote. You haven't spent the night in the same house in years. He was a liability to your campaign as it was. Don't pretend like you are going to miss him.
You concocted a plan to let Reese keep killing our business partners and didn't inform me?
The SecDef asked Horn in shock.
As much as I'd like to take credit for that part of the plan, I can't. It was all Ben's idea.
Following your jihadi's failure to take him out on the streets of L.A., Ben went a bit further off the reservation and devised a plan that allowed Reese to continue his crusade, making us all richer in the process. When he finally read me in after Reese killed Holder, Tedesco, and Pilsner, I thought it was genius. Can't believe I didn't think of it myself.
Secretary Hartley shook her head in disbelief as Horn continued. Ben's actually a lot smarter than he looks. Don't be fooled by the tattoos. He's been right about a lot of things, including the fact that Reese would make it past my contractors and into this very room. Hence, our insurance policy tied up on the floor there, he said, pointing at Katie. Your friend had more faith in your skills than I did, Mr. Reese. Well-founded, it now seems.
Here's what's going to happen, bro, Ben said. Horn is going to make us all very rich. Almost everyone else who stood to profit from this is dead, thanks to you. Yeah, you will have to do a little time, but the SecDef will pardon you with her newfound presidential powers, blaming your actions on the ravages of PTSD. I am going to disappear, never to be heard from again, and you and Katie can live happily ever after. Maybe they can even operate on that tumor of yours and save your life.
Ben looked at Katie, her eyes wide with a mixture of revulsion and horror.
Oh, and Katie is just here to ensure you make the right decision. I'm sorry about your family, Reese. I really am. Nothing can bring them back now. Let's all do the smart thing. The pardon is a gift. Katie's life is a gift. Don't fuck this up, bro.
Reese looked at Katie, then back to Ben, his eyes the picture of resolve. Horn broke the silence with a loud, slow clap, pulling himself out of his chair to take a more domineering position above the other conspirators.
Ben, that was a lovely breakdown of the plan, thank you, but I've had a change of heart. I am modifying the terms of the deal. Our negotiating power has shifted. Let's clean this mess up right now, shall we?
What do you mean, Horn?
Asked Ben skeptically.
Tonight, Commander,
Horn said, turning his attention to Reese as if presenting an investment opportunity to a client.
You get to actually save a life instead of taking one. You get to save Katie. You get to save her by dying.
Reese hadn't dropped the M4, but he did shift it toward Horn, the SecDef tensing up as the barrel passed across her face.
Come on, Reese, Horn said in an almost bored, exasperated tone. You are not leaving here alive. You are half dead now from that tumor, if I understand correctly. If you kill any of us, Ben lets go of that button and you kill the one friend you have left, who seems to be quite fond of you, by the way. Shoot yourself or let us shoot you. It matters not either way. Point being, you keep Katie alive, and we all move on with our lives.
Horn never finished his sentence. The explosion from the charge in the driveway split the SUV in half, turning the capstone security men into human mulch. The blast shattered the multitude of windows on the mansion's front and sent a shockwave through every room. Reese's first bullet caught Horn between his nose and mouth, forever leaving him with a look of surprise on what was left of his face. He was dead before he hit the ground.
No!
Screamed the SecDef, crawling up onto her chair, covering her ears with her hands. Reese's next two rounds found their way into her upper chest. A third to her head completed the job. Reese settled back on Ben.
What the fuck, Reese?
Exclaimed Ben in amazement, holding up the detonator.
What the?
Reese's M4 finished the night's deadly business, firing two 77-grain Black Hills 5.56 rounds at 2,340 feet per second, directly into Ben Edwards's face at 10 feet. His head snapped back, emptying its contents onto the chair behind him, and his hand came off the button. Katie screamed through the bandana that stifled her cries, but surprisingly, her head stayed intact. Reese stepped forward and fired 2 more rounds into Ben's face, then slung his weapon and knelt down to help Katie. He cut the bandana off her head before slicing the zip tie that held her hands behind her back. Falling forward into him, Katie sobbed uncontrollably.
"It's all right, Katie. It's all right,"
Reese repeated, stroking her hair and holding her tight to him.
"We have to go, Katie. We don't have much time. We have to go."
"Can you walk?" he asked, helping her to her feet and replacing his magazine with a fresh one from his chest rig.
"Yes, I can walk."
"Okay, follow me."
Reese led Katie outside, finding the shed he had identified on satellite imagery. Next to the shed was an old 17-foot Boston Whaler Montauk on a trailer. Gas cans were set between the boat and the shed. Reese picked up the first one, empty. Then he picked up the second one and shook it. Plenty of gas. He handed it to Katie and picked up another. Full.
"Follow me,"
Reese ordered again, already moving back to the house.
"Pour that gas around the room. Furniture, drapes, anything that will burn."
Katie did as requested. It felt good to take action against these monsters who had grabbed her in the dead of night from her brother's home. Reese doused the bodies with gas and then told Katie to run to the door. Looking down at the symbol on his father's old Zippo, Reese slid his thumb over the striker, grinding sparks off the flint and igniting the fuel to produce a flame. Tossing it onto Ben Edwards's body, Reese followed close behind. It was still raining when they hit the street, the summer home beginning to flame up behind them and the SUV smoldering in the driveway.
"Airfield is 4 miles west. Can you run that far?"
"Yes, but why don't we take this?"
Katie asked, pointing to an exquisitely restored 1973 two-tone forest green and alpine white Toyota FJ55 Land Cruiser parked next to the shed. Residents of Fisher's Island loved their classic cars. Reese couldn't suppress his grin, then looked back at the flaming house.
"I think I just melted the keys."
Katie smiled, opened the driver's side door, and pulled a set from the ignition.
"It's a Fisher's Island thing," she said.
"Well, that's working smarter. Let's go."
Reese took the wheel and Katie squeezed in beside him. They were on the road before the volunteer fire department had their boots on. Chapter 75. Reese looked at the luminous dials on his watch. Liz would be landing in 6 minutes. This was cutting it close. Her instructions were to wait for 30 minutes and then take off. If he didn't show up, she was to assume he was dead. By the time they made the 4 mile drive, Liz had already taxied to the north end of the runway, spun the plane around, and began readying for takeoff. Reese ditched the truck and moved Katie to the waiting aircraft. The door folded downward.
"Who is this?"
Liz shouted from the cabin door past the hot exhaust of the outtake.
"Liz, this is Katie. Katie, Liz."
"Well, get in and let's get out of here," Liz shot back.
"I'm not coming, Liz. I'm taking the secondary extraction. This is going to be a mess. I am not bringing you two down with me."
"Get in the fucking plane, James,"
Liz ordered impatiently. Reese ignored her and turned to Katie.
"Take this," he said, pressing a mini cassette recorder and thumb drive into her hand. "These are the only copies. Everything those bastards said in there is on the cassette, along with some other admissions from Saul Agnan. The thumb drive has all the emails and intel that Ben gave me to help back things up. That should keep you busy for a while. Somebody has to set the record straight for my men and my family. You might even get another journalism award out of it." He smiled.
"Where are you going, James?"
Katie asked, with tears beginning to stream from her eyes.
"I'm going to die, Katie. They killed me before I even left on that last deployment to Afghanistan. They killed all my guys before we even left. It's my turn now."
He ushered her up the steps. She was too shocked to say anything. Liz just glared at him with eyes that shot fire.
"Get in the plane, James,"
she tried again.
"I love you, Liz. Now get out of here."
As Reese stepped back to close the door, Katie turned sharply in her seat, snapping out of her trance.
Reese, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?
Reese paused, looked Katie in the eye, and over the sound of the wind, the propeller, and the rain, replied,
I didn't,
before shutting the door and moving off at a run toward the marina. Epilogue. Atlantic Ocean, present day. Reese awoke below deck, the sound of the Beneteau Oceanus 48 cutting through the water and the flapping of the sails waking him from his 30-minute catnap. After throwing his feet out of his bunk, he made his way topside and into the light. The storm that had kept him busy for the first 3 days after departing Fisher's Island had subsided, leaving beautiful rolling seas and steady winds. Rafe's sister, Victoria, had sailed the Beneteau from their Martha's Vineyard home down to Fisher's Island the day before Reese's assault, removing all the electronics per Reese's request. He had also instructed Rafe to report it stolen, but somehow doubted he would. That Victoria could handle the massive 48-foot sailboat on her own spoke volumes about her competence and seamanship. Reese was struggling to just keep the boat headed in the right direction. He had sailed as a kid, though nothing this large and complex. Luckily, the Navy had seen fit to send him to a civilian sailing school years ago. The idea was that he would have the ability to rent sailboats around the world and use them to conduct surveillance or to blend in with local maritime traffic and insert seals into denied areas. He didn't know how much longer he had to live. He doubted if he would make it to Europe or Africa before the tumor killed him. He was at peace, and he was ready to leave the world behind. He thought about Lucy and cried for her, for the life she would never have. And he thought about Lauren and the second child they would never bring into the world. He was ready to join them. One beautiful sunset turned into another stunning sunrise, and Reese continued to sail. Victoria had seen to it that the boat was filled with provisions for a long voyage, water, food, and medical supplies. What would he do if he were still alive when he reached the old world or the dark continent? Turn south and continue sailing until the tumor took him? Maybe he would go for a swim and never surface? Maybe that would deliver him to Lauren and Lucy? He knew he wasn't long for this world, so he might as well continue sailing until the sea or the tumor decided it was his time. Either way, his work on Earth was done. Sitting on deck, at the starboard helm steering station, the storm a distant memory and with the blaze orange sun setting behind him to the west, Reese reached into his pocket and removed a Ziploc bag. Pausing, he slowly opened it and unfolded the paper within, drawing lines through the last of the names on his list. Josh Holder, Marcus Boykin, Saul Agnan, Steve Horn,
CJNG, Mexico,
Admiral Gerald Pilsner, Mike Tedesco, J.D. Hartley, Lorraine Hartley, Leonard Howard, Hamadi Ismail Massoud, Ben Edwards. He looked at the list without a hint of remorse. It was done. Then, hesitating briefly, he turned it over and smiled, running his fingers over the crayon drawings of his beautiful wife and daughter under an arching rainbow, the perfect splendor of which only the young and innocent can capture. His eyes glistened over and a tear fell onto his most treasured possession.
I'm coming, baby girl, Reese whispered, rubbing his eyes. I'll be with you soon. I love you.
With that, he moved to the stern, and watching the sun drop below the horizon, he touched the paper to his heart and let it fall from his grasp, committing it forever to the peace and tranquility of the sea. FBI Headquarters, Washington, D.C. In the days following the revelation that Secretary of Defense Hartley and financier Steve Horn had been found shot to death and incinerated along with an unidentified body in a Fisher's Island mansion, on the heels of Congressman J.D. Hartley's targeted assassination in Soho, the conspiracy theorists went into overdrive, cluttering the internet and airways with one explanation after another. Congress appointed a special prosecutor to investigate and make sense of the mess because so many government officials were involved, all of them dead, thanks to one Lieutenant Commander James Reese,